From Washington, the American Broadcasting Company brings you Issues and Answers. Senator J. William Fulbright, Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, here are the issues. Will the President's trip do any good? What can we do about General de Gaulle? Is the time ripe for an end to the Cold War? You've heard the issues. Now for the answers from Senator J. William Fulbright, Democrat from Arkansas, Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Here to interview Senator Fulbright, ABC Capitol Hill correspondent John Rolfson, and with the first question, ABC State Department correspondent John Scali.
Senator, welcome to Issues and Answers.
Well, I'm glad to be here again.
President Kennedy's trip seems off to a fairly good start, with hundreds of thousands of Germans cheering him at every stop. Yet there are those who say that cheers and applause are about all the president will get during this trip. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree with these criticisms. It is not a timely trip. I think it may be very well. You have some changes going on. You have a new, although a caretaker government, that's said in Italy. You have the prospects of a new government in England and in Germany. I think an examination, getting acquainted with these situations and the forces that at work, may be very timely.
Well, do you get anything more except a psychological showing of the American flag at a time such as this?
Well, these great turnouts of people, I didn't mean that's particularly significant, but he undoubtedly will have serious talks with the incoming people and those that are already prospects for in the next go-round in these various governments, and I think he ought to feel his way and to get acquainted with them and to make known to all of them our serious concern about the recent developments in the so-called Atlantic Alliance and the seriousness of the effect of General de Gaulle's actions in January.
Well, Senator Fulbright, do you think a trip of this kind can do any good as a counterattack on the de Gaulle policies, for example?
I certainly do. I don't like to put it in military terms as a counterattack or so on. This is a matter of, I think, the most delicate diplomacy. And I think our objective is to bring back into focus the importance of the Atlantic Alliance, or the Atlantic Partnership, if you like. I have not abandoned that yet, although if Mr. de Gaulle or General de Gaulle has his way, I think it will be a very serious matter. And he himself, I think, may be able to change his mind if he's given a proper opportunity with proper safe face-saving mechanism built in. I don't quite think that the General de Gaulle wishes to return completely to the 18th century.
Senator, what kind of a policy would it take? What do you think we should do specifically to give this, to encourage General de Gaulle to change his mind?
Well, I think we ought to persuade all of the other countries, that is, of the importance of it. The Italians, the Germans, and the Dutch, and the Belgians. I think they are interested in building a much greater unity and cooperation among the Atlantic community, or all the free members of the free world. And this is the hope. It's been the basic theme of our policies for years. And I think General de Gaulle's action has very severely shaken the confidence that these people, all these nations, can work closely together. I think that's the greatest damage he's done. It has at least temporarily shaken the confidence that we can do it. And I think the president may well restore this. These are intangible things. I don't expect him to have a great treaty or to solve any of these problems on this trip. But I think he's a very astute political animal, and I think he understands many of these issues, and I hope he can do some good. I don't think there's anything wrong with the timing of this trip.
Isn't what you're saying, Senator, add up to a policy on our part of seeking to isolate and outflank General de Gaulle at the moment?
Well, I don't like to put it in such brutal terms. However, if you choose, I would say that's one way to put it. But I don't wish to mount quite as bluntly this kind of a contest. The general is a great patriot. I think France suffered a greater shock to their national pride than any other country. The performance of France as we all know, in the Second World War was not very creditable. It deeply wounded their pride, and she is a great nation. And I think this is a kind of a reaction to that, and I think you have to handle people who've been severely wounded in this way with kid gloves, so to speak, although I think there's a limit to what we can do. We certainly have done a lot for France.
You think perhaps the general is trying to compensate then for a bad performance during World War II?
I think he's overcompensating. I think he is overcompensating, and I think we have to make some allowances for this and have some patience. Now, I don't want to underestimate how serious I think what he's done is. I think it's very serious, and I don't know that we can. I'm still hopeful that we can overcome this and bring back into, as I say, and focus all of these countries working closely together.
Well, Senator, do you think this is purely de Gaulle, or is this the attitude of France which will outlast de Gaulle?
Well, I think the latter, if you must say so. I don't think it's so purely de Gaulle, because it wasn't just de Gaulle that was wounded by this performance. He performed better than France did during that period. But I think the whole French people were, and they had a great history. And it is not only the way they acted then and during the war, but their failure to operate a self-governing democracy throughout the period until de Gaulle, that is, operated satisfactorily with this constant changing of government, was a reflection of this restlessness and internal dissension. They could not generate any consensus within their country. These are signs of this same thing, and I do think it goes beyond just de Gaulle.
Of course, one of the justifications for the de Gaulle policy is that the United States is not necessarily permanently committed to Europe, to staying there. And one reaction in this country has been, one part of the resentment at de Gaulle has been the demand that we do pull out of Europe and let de Gaulle and France and the Europeans stew in their own juice. Doesn't this sort of justify the de Gaulle policy, this attitude in
this
country?
Well, de Gaulle does things, such as in the trade area and the way he speaks about us and so on, that tends to bring about his own prophecy. In other words, he creates conditions that may make it impossible for us to stay in force. For example, if they insist upon this policy of excluding our agriculture, if they treat all of agriculture as they have treated poultry, then it makes it impossible for us to sustain an army in Europe at the cost of $1 billion, because we already have a deficit in our balance payments. And it is possible for him, if he has his way and all of Europe cooperates with him, to make it impossible for us to stay, which will make come true his prophecy. But he will be the architect of that.
Well, do you think then that we should consider withdrawing the troops even as a threat to force de Gaulle to change his policy.
I don't like to use threats of that kind. I think we've already stated that I don't know that the president has, I can, a little freer agent than he is, that it is quite obvious we'll have to cut down our troops if they persist in these trade policies that they've started in. I think that's just a matter of financial necessity.
Senator, you mentioned the common market. Congressman Royce, among others, has written that in backing the common market, the United States government is primarily, or rather at least partially, to blame, because what we've done is encourage formation of what is a Frankenstein monster, an organization which it now develops is inward-looking, which discriminates against American tariffs, whereas our focus should have been on encouraging formation of a broader grouping of free world countries. Do you subscribe to that?
Well, I think that there is something to that. I don't know that we could have controlled it. I don't wish to always bring up and say I told you so, but it is a fact that when the Marshall Plan was first introduced, I and some of my colleagues attempted to have incorporated in that as a policy the unification of Europe at that time as a part of the Marshall Plan on a broader scale than just the six. And I think this would have been preferable, and I think it would have been a very wise thing to do. The Secretary of State at that time, Dean Acheson, was opposed to this policy. I think this is a question of timing. He thought that it was too much to ask of them at that time in 48 to make great political changes as well as economic adjustments, and therefore our government didn't support it. I think it was a mistake. And I agree with you that it should have been done that way. Nevertheless, I think that in view of the fact that the two last world wars were generated by the frictions among these very countries, that some kind of cooperative unification of Europe was called for. Now, the fact that it's presently inward-looking is too bad. Our job is to try to make it outward-looking. But I wouldn't regret the fact that they are moving toward unity in Europe.
I think perhaps this idea goes a little beyond that, though, that in the past and possibly still now, what we should have done, should be doing, is not only encouraging a united Europe independent of us, but making a greater commitment ourselves in this organization, economically,
well,
and politically.
I would agree with that. I didn't get that point. I agree with that. Yes, we should. But there's a great resistance here in our country to do it, but I would favor that, and I think we ought to do that.
What would you do?
Well, one of the things I recently suggested is a very minor thing, was the creation of what we call an Atlantic Consultative Assembly, to make the step toward bringing their people and ours together in a regular, institutionalized manner. The representatives of all of these countries, including beyond the six, including the Scandinavians.
For lawmaking purposes?
We're talking, no, I say consultative assembly. This is the first step. I don't think you could get that step. These changes, you know, as Eric Hoffer puts it, the ordeal of change is a very serious matter, and to get anyone to adjust to a new idea is a major undertaking, and I just think you'd fail. Now, I think they would allow, perhaps, a consultative assembly, which has been recommended as a result of the meeting, you remember, that Herter and Will Clayton sponsored, or our principal representative. I think this is a step in that direction, and this would, it's consistent with the OECD. The OECD is demanding a parliamentarians conference, and if we could merge that with, in a way, with the NATO Parliamentarians Conference, maybe we can get a conference including more than the six, and then we could move toward consultative bodies, and then later perhaps to something stronger. You can't foresee how it would develop, but that's one thing we could do.
Senator, if we can turn to the broader East-West picture for a moment, do you see any real opportunity in the days ahead of an accommodation between the United States and Russia, which might flow out of the speech that the President made June 10, where he called for a re-examination of the Cold War concept?
Well, I approve of the speech. I don't think there's going to be any great sudden change in this business. I favor the gradual change as being the only realistic one. I do think that there are various circumstances that are moving now in a direction which might make it possible to alleviate the tensions of the Cold War. The Chinese-Russian discussion is one of them. The vast cost of these military armament programs, which must affect Russia as it affects us, and I think general settling down of their activities. I notice they are curbing their foreign aid program. I think they're disillusioned with their experience in Iraq and Indonesia and other places. I think the prospects that we're going to do it for different reasons than theirs, but some of the same reasons. I think there is a possibility here. They haven't been too offensive about Berlin lately, and so on. I think it's timely, and I think an expression by the President of this kind leads to a discussion. I would hope such discussions can take place, and small tentative agreements made, tentative in the sense that they don't solve the problem. But honestly, I think when you examine the great problems that we're having internally and that they're having between China, it creates further matters which we have in common.
Senator, you listed the Russian-Chinese conference as one of the things that might alleviate it. Does that mean that you see out of this conference coming a softer Chinese line rather than a harder Russian line?
No, I would hope that it will confirm in the Russians' mind that they have more in common with the Western peoples, the Europeans, as well as ourselves, than they do the Chinese. Because the Chinese, if I interpret what they're saying, is that they do not accept the concept of coexistence. They demand the continuation of violence, violent revolutions, wherever they are, can be had and can be promoted. And I think the Russians recognize the danger themselves. If we have a nuclear war, the Russians are more conscious of the destruction of a possible nuclear war. And they have more to lose in another sense, having accomplished a good deal in the rebuilding of their country. There are many reasons of this nature which I think might lead the Russians to take a different view from the Chinese. The Chinese give every evidence of having very little fear of a nuclear war. And furthermore, the Chinese are much closer to the Russians than they are to us. We get excited about Cuba. Well, what about if you had 600 million people right on your borders, as the Russians have? Well, why wouldn't you be excited about that? When we have only 6 million down here, 90 miles from our coast. Senator, all of these go together. Well, I think it's worth examining anyway. And I thought his statement there was worthwhile.
Senator, you mentioned the possibility of some tentative agreements in limited areas. Do you think that these should be explored and pursued at the diplomatic working level, or perhaps elevated to the point of a summit conference?
No, I think the first. That's where they should be explored, at the lower level, diplomatic and at most ministerial, before you get. I'm not an advocate of summit meetings before you get anywhere.
In that connection, as you know, Avril Harriman is flying to Moscow in mid-July. Do you see this as perhaps one of the wedges that could open this whole area?
This is the sort of thing that ought to be going on all the time, and to discuss these matters. Now, they have apparently agreed on the so-called hotline. I wouldn't overemphasize its significance, but it's something. Now, I think they are still hopeful that maybe something in the test ban area might be developed. Nothing concrete has yet come out. Now, I don't know that it will, but I think we ought to keep plugging on these matters. After all, are you still faced with the alternative of this finally escalating into a nuclear war if we don't do something?
Senator, the Republican leadership in Congress was extremely scornful of this whole American University speech, the nuclear test and all the rest, and the idea that our policy should try to encourage the Russians toward a more enlightened policy and so forth. And they complained that the president was shooting from the hip without consulting with them. Do you think that there is some big error here in the administration in not bringing the Republicans in more at the beginning of such policies as these?
Well, I rather think it would be wise to consult more with them, although I'm not personally aware of just how little he has consulted. Naturally, if he consults with them, I don't always know it. And I'm not always there. I think, on the other hand, everybody's beginning, I think, prematurely to become interested in the 64 election. I think that colors this a little bit. There's a tremendous ad in this morning's paper, a whole full-page ad with a great national rally for Mr. Goldwater already here within a week or two. I think this is going to make it a long campaign. But I do think that it's wise to consult the opposition. Any government that's in power.
Of course, the opponents of this new presidential approach characterize it as a sign that the accommodators have taken over the direction of our foreign policy. They don't answer when they say, well, do you mean appeaser? They say, no, we'll let the word accommodator stand.
I regret this revival. This is what they emphasized in the early 50s under McCarthy, and they've always thought this is pay dirt, this is politically profitable. They've, I think, overworked Cuba for this same reason, seeking to say that Democrats are soft on communism.
I'm sorry, Senator, I'm going to have to interrupt. Our time is up. Thank you very much, Senator Fulbright, for being with us on Issues and Answers.
Thank you for inviting me.
This concludes this week's Issues and Answers with Senator J. William Fulbright. Of 26 African countries have protested remarks made on this program last Sunday by Senator Alan J. Ellender, Democrat of Louisiana. We have therefore invited the spokesman for these African nations to take the remaining time to present his views. Here is His Excellency S. Edward Peel, Liberian Ambassador to the United States.
Senator Ellender of Louisiana, on this television network last Sunday, referred to my country Liberia and Ethiopia and Haiti as examples of the Negroes' inability to govern themselves. This was not the first time he had shown such eagerness to insult us, and by singling out those three countries, he had, of course, in his mind all the emerging states in Africa and the Caribbean and the whole Negro race. I am therefore grateful to this station for the opportunity to reply to him, not only for the reason that I naturally feel, as do all my colleagues from the African countries, that his repeated slurs on the people of an increasingly important continent and a race that has made such great contributions to the progress of this country should be subject to rebuke and correction, but also because I know most Americans sympathize with our feelings in this matter and can understand our resentment of an apparent crusade to stigmatize us as inferior human beings. That we are wounded goes without saying, for the facts which the senator cites are misleading. But what is even more tragic is that the cause of human brotherhood, for the advancement of which so many Americans, white and Negro alike, in our own lifetimes have made such heroic sacrifices, is stricken too. Why should a single senator, much as he may wish to assuage his conscience for his own support of discriminatory practices, be allowed to do such harm to relations between your great country and the African states? Relations which it should be the duty of all of us to seek to strengthen. We Liberians are not allergic to criticism, but when it comes from our reputed friends, we have a right to expect that it should be constructive and lightened by at least a glimmer, perhaps even a glow of sympathy. Othello, in the agony of his final hours, begged that posterity should speak of me as I am, nothing extinguished. But he added the crucial proviso, nor set down aught in malice. There is no malice more savage, more senseless, more destructive of charity and self-respect than racial malice. The gist of the matter is this. Are we willing to come to grips with the overriding realities of our times as brothers, belonging to the same human family, or are we to go our separate ways with our own pride, our own prejudice, our own pigmentation to our very certain and very final doom? I do not put that question to Senator Ellender. I put it to you, while Africa awaits your answer.
Next week at this same time, our guest will be the former director of the United States Central Intelligence Agency, Mr. Alan W. Dulles. We hope you'll be with us. Issues and Answers is produced by Peggy Wheaton. A presentation of ABC News. Hear news around the world morning on the ABC Radio Network.